This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with Kerry Jr. II. He is our producer.
Producer at large.
Producer at large. Is that the new title?
I don't know. I just threw that
That's
in there.
That's pretty fancy.
Put me on the spot. I just throw stuff in
that
there.
That should come with a pay raise, I think.
Hey, now we're talking.
Producer at large.
We're going to get in trouble now.
So today, Kerry, we're talking about a really interesting part of U.S. history that's also Michigan history.
I think of Cass Avenue and Anthony Wayne Drive and how those are named after Lewis Cass, the former governor, and Anthony Wayne, the former soldier. And we learned about them and how they were actors, among others, in the transfer of land from Native Americans to the British settlers in Robert Downs' book.
Yeah. So Robert Downs is an author and publisher who has a new book out called Raw Deal, The Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. And it talks specifically about all the ways that places like Michigan in particular really took advantage of the people who were here to create what we know as home today. Robert Downs, welcome to Created Equal.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I think anyone who has even the smallest bit of consciousness about American history understands that indigenous Americans got a raw deal from Europeans who came here. That's the title of your book. Tell me what inspired you to write about indigenous Americans, and what do you mean when you use that phrase, raw deal?
Well, raw deal, the subtitle is The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. And I wanted to write this book because growing up, when we attended school, we learned almost nothing about the Native peoples who had lived in Michigan for up to 13,000 years. Mm-hmm. And even the best-selling history books of the time would only give about two or three pages to the history of the Indians, and barely nothing at all about the bad faith treaties that they were forced to sign. Basically at gunpoint, you know, it was implied that they were going to be shipped west of the Mississippi if they didn't sign these five major treaties in which they gave away all of Michigan. Mm-hmm. So, but my story goes a lot deeper than that. If you got a minute, yeah. I started out my life on my grandfather's farm near Rockford, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And my father was a farmer. And in the 1940s and the 50s, he plowed up, hundreds of arrowheads and spear points and flushing tools and all this just on a 100-acre farm. So from a very early age, I realized that there were far, far more Indians or indigenous people living in our continent than we have been led to believe.
Right. I mean, that's a remarkable thing to have happen. You're farming your land, mm-hmm. and you're finding little clues about history and a people who've been not just moved away, but erased from our memories.
Absolutely. We know now that there were at least 50 million Indians living in North and South America prior to European explorers coming here and spreading these catastrophic diseases. Now, in the contiguous United States, there were about 15 million Indians.
Wow.
And they had these magnificent civilizations that were pretty much wiped out in the 1500s by the conquistadors brought all these diseases such as smallpox and measles and diphtheria and the like. And I go deeply into that too. My book ranges all the way back to the Ice Age to the present. But, you know, there's some chapters about these civilizations and the impact the conquistadors had on them.
Yeah. So your father is plowing up these little bits of history. What impression does that leave on you? How does that lead you to your work?
Very good question. Because from a very early age, I realized that if there had been all of these spear points and dart points and arrowheads on our little 100-acre farm, there had to be hundreds of thousands within a few square miles. And as I said, I realized even as a child that there were a lot more Native peoples living in Michigan than we had been led to believe. So I spent my, I read everything I could about the Indians. I've always been fascinated with them. And I, as I got older, I also, I moved from the Detroit area to Traverse City and took up a lot of backpacking and hiking in what had been the country of the Ojibwe and the Ottawa. And one of those, some of those were winter camping trips in very harsh conditions, even on the shores of Lake Superior in the winter. And I got to thinking, I was inspired that the Ojibwe and the Ottawa and the Potawatomi were able to live in these drastic conditions and thrive. And so I was kind of filled with the spirit of their achievement and also, of course, the wilderness of northern Michigan. And this led me, long story short, to write a short story for my own edification, just something fun for me to do. I wrote a story about a hunter being pursued by his a mortal enemy in the winter, trying to feed his family. Then I went on to launch a newspaper up here called Northern Express. And my partner and I ran that for 22 years. Well, we sold the paper and I got back to wondering about that hunter. I wrote another story, sent that into the Grand Rapids Art Prize, which had a writing contest at the time, and it won first prize. So I took those two stories and turned them into my first novel of the Ojibwe called Wendigo Moon.
So tell us about the history, I guess, of this farm where your father was plowing and turning up all of these artifacts. What was that land before your father had it?
Well, that land was all the homeland of the Ottawa Indians who had moved there in the 1700s, the early 1700s. And there was even a small mound at the far end of the cornfield that we thought might have been an Indian mound. Well, as it turned out, years after I wrote my novels of the Ojibwe, Wendigo Moon, and also The Wolf and the Willow, I learned that my great-great-great-grandfather, one of them, had benefited from the loss of this land, the Ottawa's loss of this land in the Treaty of 1836. So the Ottawa had established their own farms, their own orchards, their own trading networks, all along the Grand River Valley from Grand Rapids, inland a good 50 miles or so. And in 1836, they were forced to sign this treaty that gave up nearly 40% of Michigan. Well, my distant ancestor had benefited from this terrible treaty, and he was selling this land in return to other settlers, Irish settlers.
Wow!
So that was the land that our farm was on. And I should mention too that these arrowheads and spear points that my father dug up weren't necessarily from the Ottawa Indians. They're from a far older culture that had existed there up to 7,000 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, I had an archaeologist from Michigan State University examine these, and some of them were mined hundreds of miles away by an unknown people. And I have an axe head that's 7,000 years old from the farm.
My goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
So in a way, the work that you're doing asks you to confront not just American history, not just European history. Mm-hmm. It asks you to confront your own history.
Absolutely. Way back when I learned this thing about my ancestor, I was appalled, of course, because I thought my family had nothing to do with this. And he was on my grandmother's side of the family. You know, we always think of our paternal grandparents for some reason, but our maternal grandparents are just as important or more so. We wouldn't be alive without them. Mm-hmm. So the years went by. I didn't really want to write the book, but inevitably, the muse took hold of me, and I spent 3 years writing this book, and a lot of research went into it. I've got a library of about 100 books on Native peoples and anthropology. And of course, there are many, many other sources that went into it.
Yeah. So I imagine that, confronting this from a professional standpoint also pushes you to think about it from a personal standpoint. Have you talked with members of your family about this history and what it means?
Oh, well, only my brother is still with us. Mm-hmm. Of course, he's got an interest, but I was more interested in sharing this with the people of Michigan who know, most of us know virtually nothing at all about the Native peoples who lived here and these terrible treaties they were forced to sign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you're thinking about this raw deal that takes place, this is something that happens, as you point out, over a long period of time. You know, I think when people think about the things, the interactions between Europeans and Indigenous Americans, they think of one or two things that might have been done, but it's really a centuries long relationship that goes against the Indigenous Americans almost every time.
Yes, the Indians were making treaties with the French and the British and the Spanish starting in the early 1600s, but in our own country's situation, there were 367 treaties signed between 1791 and the 1880s.
Wow.
So, yeah, 367, and that deprived the Native peoples of something like 1.5 billion acres. And, things generally went from bad to worse, because when a tribe was forced to sign a treaty for a variety of reasons, they usually were shortchanged thereafter by not receiving what was agreed upon, mm-hmm. or having that land stolen, the small reservations that they were granted stolen out from under their feet. So this is still a problem for Native peoples today.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Robert Downs, author of Raw Deal, The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
We're back with Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad that you have decided to join us. We're talking with Robert Downs. He's an author and a publisher, and he's written a book titled Raw Deal, The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. We're talking to him about his book and about his work researching the history of indigenous Americans, especially here in the state of Michigan. Bob, I want to start this segment talking about a figure in our history who is more familiar, I guess, than the history of indigenous Americans to most of us in Southeast Michigan. General Anthony Wayne is the namesake of the largest county in the state of Michigan, Wayne County. Those of us who live in Southeast Michigan, of course, are very familiar with that name and with the county. But he plays an integral role in the relationship between new Americans, settlers coming here, and the indigenous people.
Yes, and the namesake of my alma mater, Wayne State University,
right?
Too.
And
also,
right.
he was considered a real tough guy in the mode of Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone way back. And a guy named Marion Morrison took his name to become John Wayne. That's John Wayne was adopted that name.
He's a namesake of Anthony Wayne. That's right.
Yeah. I've got two chapters on Anthony Wayne in the book. You know, Stephen, the biggest loss ever suffered by the United States military, this all ties into Wayne, mm-hmm. was the Battle of the 1,000 Slain, it was called. It was Arthur St. Clair, who they named Lake St. Clair after. Mm-hmm. He led an expedition against the United Tribes of the Anishinaabeg, the Potawatomi, Ojibwe, Ottawa, the Miami people, and the Shawnee, and many other tribes. They were holding the line at the Ohio River. And Arthur St. Clair led an army up their way and got his ass kicked from here to next Sunday with more than 800 of his troops and camp followers killed off. And, you know, a lot of people think that Custer's Last Stand was the greatest battle ever fought by the Indians, but that's not true at all. The greatest battles ever fought by the Indians were right here in the Midwest and in Pennsylvania. Well, the upshot of this is that General George Washington designated Mad Anthony Wayne to come in and wipe out this alliance of Native peoples. And at that time, there was no United States Army. So this was, the Indians had destroyed one third of the military forces of the United States.
Wow.
That'd be like if we today, one third of the Air Force, Marines, Army, and Navy were destroyed. You know?
Wow.
So this was the biggest, proportionally the biggest defeat in American history. And Anthony Wayne, the native peoples called him the Black Snake because he crept along with his troops over a 2-year period into their territory in Ohio and Indiana, and he never slept. They could never get the drop on him. And he ended up defeating the native warriors at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, which is just a few miles south of Detroit, mm-hmm. you know, maybe, well, 70 miles. Definitely a good day trip for your listeners.
It's down around Monroe, isn't that
right?
Yeah,
it's Maumee.
Or is it further
south of Monroe?
Okay.
Yeah. And anyway, this crushed this alliance of Indians, and it was the first major treaty in which they were forced into a small area in northwestern Ohio, the Shawnee tribe was once one of the biggest tribes in America, and the Miami people. And eventually they too, even on this small area they were granted, they were forced at gunpoint west of the Mississippi to what was then called Indian country, meaning the bleak reservations of the Kansas and Great Plains.
So, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Today we have steamrolled all of these Confederate monuments and namesakes and all that, but we still honor Anthony Wayne. Hamtramck was one of his generals. Arthur St. Clair with place names. And we forget that these guys did search and destroy missions against thousands of Native peoples live here, because after Wayne had crushed the Indians at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, well, he set about burning their orchards, burning their villages, burning their crops, then they would take hostages of women and children as bargaining chips against any remaining warriors. So it wasn't, these people are still honored in their place names throughout, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Sure.
Everywhere, you know.
So I want to talk about what the motivation was for General Wayne and as you point out, George Washington, who's dispatching these generals to break up this alliance of indigenous tribes. Obviously, land was one of the motivations, but it wasn't really the only thing that was on their minds.
But mainly it was, Stephen, because in 1791, under the Articles of Confederation, the first American Congress had no right to levy taxes. The new Republic of the United States was stone broke, and what Washington and Jefferson and the other founding fathers figured out was they had all of this land over the mountains, which all of these settlers were hungry to have. So what they decided to do was obtain the land from the Indians at pennies per acre, or usually far less, and then sell it for a buck or two per acre to these settlers. Now, at the
time, to make money for the government.
It was a huge. If Native peoples had been able to sell their land outright, they would have come out far ahead. At the time. There were 10,000 settlers going down the Ohio River in the late 1700s looking for their piece of land. Land was everything. If you were from Europe, you had been living for centuries or even thousands of years under the iron heel of a landlord. Mm-hmm. So you could come over here and be a baron practically with this land. It was like unimaginable riches to these dirt poor farmers.
Yeah.
So Congress, at the same time they were scheming to do this, they created what was called the Northwest Territory that included Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and part of Minnesota. And they said that as soon as any of these areas gained 60,000 citizens, they could become a state, which is how Michigan became a state in 1837. Well, just to continue on with this, after General Wayne had crushed the Indian Alliance, the first major treaty in Michigan was the Treaty of Detroit in 1807. And that in that one, William Hull purchased something like 8 million acres for 1/10 of a cent per acre.
Wow. My goodness.
Yeah. And then they turn around and sell it for a buck or two an acre.
Right. And as you point out, it brought revenue to a government that didn't have taxing power.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't the first tax in American history was an excise tax on whiskey
right.
in 1794, and that kicked off the whiskey rebellion.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said something earlier that I want to go back to. You know, I think a lot of people assume or believe that this was being done to unsophisticated, savage cultures, right? I mean, there's an incredible compendium of depictions of indigenous people in that way. But earlier you were talking about how sophisticated and complex their civilizations actually were. I want to have you talk a little more about that in the context of this campaign to remove them from their land by force, if necessary.
Yes, that's an important part of my book. I go into the Copper Age with the Hopewell and Adena and Mississippian cultures, in which they had created these governmental units called chiefdoms. Mm-hmm. Now, a chiefdom would include sort of a capital, generally with a pyramid, a number of pyramids for ceremonial reasons and a palisade. And then there'd be outlying villages. So there were many of these chiefdoms across the United States. In Georgia, for instance, the chiefdom of Coosa stretched for 400 miles and had 50,000 residents. Mm-hmm. In Texas, another chiefdom had 200,000 residents. And all of these were destroyed mostly by Hernan de Soto, a conquistador who rampaged through the Southeast looking for gold and treasure and spreading smallpox and diseases everywhere. So a lot of what the 1500s have been called the lost century by some historians because of the incredible anarchy and devastation that happened during this time because of these diseases. Mm-hmm. They killed off up to 90% of the people. And so a lot of the tribes that emerged from this catastrophe were remnant tribes, and they weren't as populous or as powerful as they had once been. So they were easier prey for the colonists that came after.
Yeah, yeah. So let's mm-hmm. talk about these negotiations between the indigenous cultures and the settlers.
Yes.
Why would the indigenous Americans even bother negotiating with the British? I mean, what was the motivation?
Excellent question, Stephen. And there's a very simple answer. When the Native peoples first met the French in the early 1600s, they were astounded and very pleased to receive these technological advancements, metal pots and pans, iron axes, steel knives, muskets, manufactured clothing. This made their lives so much easier. Mm. And they were just amused that all the French wanted was, you know, beaver skins, which were all over the place, you know. There were 600 million beaver in North America when the French arrived. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, these traders egged the Indians on to hunt the beaver and other species, fur-bearing species, to almost extinction. And then by that time, a lot of Native peoples had lost the survival skills they once had or had no desire to return to them, any more than any of us would desire to return to plowing a field with oxen for subsistence mm-hmm. farming. Mm-hmm. So what the Native peoples had, nothing left to trade, was their land. And they were usually under the gun to trade it, too. And a lot of them had married into these traders had married into their families. And so they egged them on to make these treaties too. Mm. So basically, it was these colossal debts to traders that were a big part of why the native people sold their land.
Yeah.
Now add to that, the concept of buying land initially or selling land was completely unknown to them. If I were to ask you if I could buy the sun or the wind or the clouds, you might say, well, what could it hurt? Right. And and so that was their perspective too. They had no idea what selling land would mean. That land was a commons. And they had no idea that there were 7 million people on the Atlantic seaboard who were just dying to get a piece of it.
Right.
And what it meant to sell their land.
Yeah. Here in Michigan, as you point out, there were many treaties. And they are treaties that bear the names of the places that we that we are familiar with now. I mean, so many places, Detroit, Saginaw.
Yes.
These are not just names that evoke indigenous people and their culture. They define the transactions that took place that took land from them.
Yes, as you noted, the Treaty of 1807, the Treaty of Detroit, that was a big chunk of southeastern Michigan. And next came the Treaty of 1819, which was the Treaty of Saginaw. And all of these towns, Flint, Saginaw, Frankenmuth, and the like in that area were once Indian villages. And Lewis Cass, who was territorial governor at the time, forced the Ojibwe to sell this land. Well, he didn't, and he did it with the use of alcohol. He was really big on going to these treaties and getting the Indians inebriated, and and they had no clue as to how disastrous alcohol was initially, or how potent it was.
Yeah,
and he had.
I mean,
Lewis
Cass is a name that comes up a lot in controversy nowadays, right? Our most prestigious public high school in Detroit is named for him. We have a street, of course, that WDET is on. In fact, that's named for him, and there are a lot of people who think because of the things he did to indigenous people as well as to African Americans are reasons he should not be honored that way.
Well, yeah, he had ordered 600 gallons of whiskey to lubricate the Treaty of Saginaw. He didn't end up with that much, but that was the level he was thinking at.
Yeah.
You know,
if they're drunk, they won't necessarily be able to think through the deal that you're presenting them.
As a matter of fact, there was one chieftain, Kishkaukau was his name, and he was adamantly opposed to selling the land in the Saginaw River Valley. Mm-hmm. Lewis Cass had him kept drunk out of his mind for 10 days while these negotiations went on. And at the end of the treaty signing, he opened up all this whiskey and wine and gin and passed it out. And there was this really wild revel that, nearly turned in. Well, one guy got stabbed and all this, but that was par for the course, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking with Robert Downs, author of Raw Deal, The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. We're We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for joining. We're talking with Robert Downs, an author and a publisher, author of a book titled Raw Deal, The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. Bob, I want to talk about now and what we do or how we should be thinking about what to do about this raw deal that you detail in your book. I mean, certainly there's a lot of education that needs to take place about what happened, but it seems to me that there are still wounds that were inflicted that need healing. There's damage that was done that we ought to be thinking about how to repair.
Well, sort of towards the end of the book, I talk about a couple of instances, the Grand Traverse Band here in the Traverse City area and the Little Traverse Band in up near Petoskey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a very, very deep subject. This book could have easily gone on for 6,000 pages, you know. It's a little under 300. But basically, the Grand Traverse Band was granted 87,000 acres in 1855. And then over the course of 40 years, they lost almost all of it. They remained only 700 acres due to theft and malfeasance. And so they lost, they ended up with about 700 acres out of the 87,000 acres they'd been granted. And a similar situation happened up near Petoskey. So these bands of Ottawa and Ojibwe Indians have been fighting in the courts even up to the present day to get back some of their sovereignty, not necessarily to get all the land back, which is, you know, that horse has left the barn, but you know, the rights to you know, relating to health, emergency services, policing, and the like. I should mention that the book has kind of a happy ending in that it tells a story of how the native peoples were able to obtain the right to have casinos on their reservations. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a tale. And that, of course, lifted them out of abject poverty. Right. And, you know, they have a share the wealth today. Before I go into that, though, just to mention, the book does cover the Pottawatomie Trail of Trail of Death, uh-huh, in which hundreds of Pottawatomie were forced at gunpoint from southern Michigan and northern Indiana to Kansas. And it also starts out with the Chippewa Trail of Tears, or the Wisconsin Death March, in which 400 Ojibwe died as a result of a very evil government plan to force them west of the Mississippi.
Yeah, yeah.
But
to talk about the casinos and the fact that many people believe that that's good enough, right? They have casinos now, so that should be enough for all of the things that were taken from them.
That did get them started on the path to recovery. Well, in 1972, this woman Helen Bryan and her husband on the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota, they had their house burned down. So they were able to buy a trailer, a two-bedroom trailer. Mm-hmm. Well, one day they're looking out their window and they see this white man walking around outside, making notes on their property. And soon thereafter, they got their first property tax bill they'd ever received. Mm. And then they quickly got another property tax bill, and they had a bunch of kids and really couldn't afford to pay these bills. So they took it to their local tribal legal counsel, and their case went first to the local court and then to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they were turned down flat. You know, the state upheld, said that they had to pay property taxes. Well, in 1976, this case went all the way to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And Justice Brennan and the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that not only did the state and local governments have the right to levy property taxes on Native reservations, but they had no right to regulate those reservations either.
Right.
So the Seminole Indians in Florida, based on this this ruling, launched a bingo parlor. And it was shut down the same day by Broward County. But the Supreme Court upheld their right to have a bingo parlor. Mm-hmm. Other Indians started doing this. And then in 1980, Ronald Reagan ruled that, yes, indeed, the Supreme Court ruling did stand. And Native peoples had the right to have gaming establishments, provided the federal government regulated them and states got a chunk of the action. Mm-hmm. So basically, because this one woman was taxed on her mobile home, this brought about, you know, multi-billion dollar industry for Native peoples that lifted them out of poverty, and they're able to more pursue you know, their old traditions now, and it's sort of as happy an ending as there could be in the book.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do we get to a space where more people understand this history and how important it is to the way we mm-hmm. think of Indigenous people now, and the way we think of ourselves? All of these things, all of these cities that are named for Indigenous tribes, all of the people we honor who did horrible things to
Native
people.
That is actually the goal of my book, is to you know, to educate people. And I think that I have a little bit of advantage in that I have a background of 30 years as a journalist and as a novelist. So people who've read the book say it's very easily readable. Mm-hmm. It's not a scholarly, you know, a lot of stuff, not to disparage them, but a lot of things I read by college professors tend to be written for academics and can be kind of some tough going. My book, what I've been very happy hearing from Native readers and us white folks alike, is that they find it very readable and enjoyable. You can skip around in it, and you'll learn. You know, I mean, each of these treaties, these major treaties, five treaties signed in Michigan, it tells the characters behind them and the consequences.
Yeah,
and that's important for us to know. You know, I mean, we need to know about people who lived here for up to 13,000 years.
How does that relate to your own personal story? This history of the land that your father was farming, has this made you think differently about how to commemorate what was there before, or how to remunerate the people who might have been swindled out of that land?
Yeah, it's not exactly a penance, but it's my way of paying it forward, in a sense, to try and educate people, because we all of us who live in Michigan, we walk in the footsteps of Native peoples who are only a few generations gone. Mm-hmm. Our cities are built on the sites that once were Indian villages. Our highways travel along their ancient trails. And when we walk down the street, any street in this state, we're walking on artifacts that are thousands of years old that are buried not only in the earth, but in our collective memory. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that by learning that, we really kind of enrich ourselves with an understanding of the past. And it makes life in Michigan, in a way, more, I don't know, enjoyable is the term, but inspiring. Yeah. Inspiring, you know.
What about Indigenous people now? What's their response to what you're doing and the book?
I've had a lot of readers who have enjoyed my novels, Wendigo Moon and The Wolf and the Willow. These are set in the 1500s before European explorers arrived. I just spoke to a Potawatomi book club down in Indiana and in southwestern Michigan the day before yesterday, and they all enjoyed my book a great deal, and they're started on Raw Deal themselves. And they shared their experience with the Potawatomi Trail of Death and the upshot of that. So I've been very gratified that quite a few Native people have read my books and, keep it going.
Yeah. I want to end with the fight for land and the fact that it still continues. We still continue to have an argument about the land and how to make sure that people are made whole by what they lost. What's a reasonable expectation in your estimation for doing that?
Well, that's a very knotty situation sure. that hasn't been resolved much to Native satisfaction in the courts. The Burt Lake Band, for instance, up by Sheboygan, they suffered a burnout in 1900, where a guy, a timberman. He went and burned their village down with the help of a local sheriff.
Wow.
And just because he wanted to seize their land for its timber. Well, that problem exists to this very day, where the Burt Lake Band of Native peoples living in this area still today have not received federal recognition. And that's a problem for many tribes is first they were bamboozled out of their land, and then they were told by the federal government they had no right to exist because they didn't have any land, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's their situation up there. And so how this all is resolved is going to be a long series of lengthy court cases and petitioning to Congress. And, it's not an easy path.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we can, I think it will help us if we simply learn about some of the history and some of the problems faced, and they're epic.
Yeah. Well, and if we, mm-hmm. if we started thinking about the way we honor some of the people who did this, who took from the Indigenous people, Lewis Cass, Anthony Wayne. I mean, there's a long list of folks who are heroes still in at least the current culture.
Well, it's deeply woven into our culture. Henry Schoolcraft, for instance, who oversaw the Treaty of 1836, mm-hmm. He named, maybe a dozen or 20 counties after fake Indian names he came up with. You know, Leelanau County, Lenawee mm-hmm. County. These were just names he made up out of the blue.
Wow.
So all of that stuff, you know, Cass's legacy, Wayne, Arthur Sinclair's legacy, that's all deeply woven, and how you would change it, I have no idea.
Yeah. No, it's a discussion for another day.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, right. Robert Downs, it was really, really wonderful to have you here to talk about the history of indigenous people here in Michigan and the raw deal they got in your book, Raw Deal, yes. The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. Thanks so much for doing
and
this.
I might add that there's a lot in there about the history of Detroit and the relationship with, you know, Pontiac and Tecumseh. So, Miigwech to everybody, and thank you for having me, Stephen. Yes. It's a real honor to be here.
Oh, thanks for being with us. That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.